From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Monday, May 11th, 2015. Clemson University's Chenjerai Kumanyika joins us in studio to discuss media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement and how people are fighting back and creating their own media. And Mexican-American performance artist Nao Bustamante will discuss Soldaderas, the women of the Mexican Revolution. That's coming up today after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Rahul Mahajan, sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Hi, Rahul.
Hi, Sonali.
About 2,000 people hailing from Bangladesh and from the Rohingya community of Myanmar have been rescued from several boats over the last 2 days off of the shores of Indonesia and Malaysia. Rohingya are a persecuted community of Muslims from the northern region of Myanmar called Rakhine. There were some women and children among those rescued. The migrants had apparently been stranded by traffickers and told to swim ashore. According to interviews with some of the migrants, they had been at sea for 2 months and were extremely hungry and weak, and they were headed to Malaysia and Thailand to find work. In recent months, the Thai government has cracked down on refugees. According to the UNHCR, about 25,000 Rohingya from Myanmar and Bangladeshis have attempted to migrate by sea during the first 3 months of 2015 alone. That's twice the number from last year. Now, Rahul, we've been hearing much about the crisis of immigration in Europe, but very little about this crisis. Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess the first thing is that, especially for the American media, the definition, something is a crisis insofar as it affects the lives of what you might think of as people like us, which means mostly white, middle class, and first world. And if there are no effects on either end, as is the case of Burmese refugees going into Thailand, it's very, very difficult for something to mount to the level of a crisis. I think it's also true that with regard to the Rohingya in particular, it's been very difficult for people to talk very much or say very much about it when there is so little sort of opposition to what's being done from inside Burma. Even sadly, from Aung San Suu Kyi has remained pretty much silent on the issue. Mm-hmm.
Houthi rebels and their allies in Yemen have agreed to a 5-day ceasefire on Sunday to allow for humanitarian assistance to reach civilians trapped in a war against Saudi Arabia and the U.S. UN agencies have been warning in recent days of a humanitarian catastrophe if aid was not allowed to reach vulnerable populations in the Arab world's poorest nation. The ceasefire is set to start tomorrow. However, airstrikes on Sunday hit the house of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was ousted in an Arab Spring revolution and who supports the Houthi cause. Saudi King Salman has said he will not attend the Gulf Cooperation Council summit at Camp David because of the ceasefire and will send his representatives instead. King Salman was scheduled to meet with President Obama. The Arab Kingdom was quick to insist that Salman's absence did not indicate a snub to Obama. Well, Rahul, how important is the ceasefire in Yemen? And by the way, is too much being made of Salman's absence at Camp David?
It's hard to know with ceasefires right at the beginning what to make of them. In this case, I think it's certainly a good sign that both sides are willing to allow for at least a humanitarian pause. I mean, there have been we've seen other rebel groups in the region that don't seem to have such consideration, so the Houthis get credit for that. Beyond that, it's very hard to say. And with regard to King Salman, again, I think that if he wanted to do a real snub, I doubt that he would have sent the crown prince.
Finally, prominent investigative journalist Seymour Hersh released one of his trademark bombshell exposés over the weekend. In a lengthy article in the London Review of Books, Hersh revisited the 2011 U.S. raid in Pakistan that resulted in the killing of Osama bin Laden. The story, when it first came out, was that the U.S. raid on bin Laden's Abbottabad compound was conducted without the knowledge of Pakistani authorities. But Hersh, based on interviews with some Pakistani sources, maintains that in fact the raid was conducted with full knowledge and cooperation with Pakistan. Bin Laden had apparently been imprisoned at the compound by Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Bureau for a number of years. Well, Rahul, if Hersh's report is true, does it undermine the heroic narrative of the U.S. finding and eliminating bin Laden in this Hollywood movie-style raid that we saw? Are there any serious implications of the story beyond that, as far as you can tell?
Well, I think the heroic narrative had largely unraveled. I mean, we've known for quite some time that bin Laden didn't fight, that there was at most one fighting man in the compound, and that it was accomplished with
Rahul, we're going to try to bring. Yes, go ahead.
regard to
You
with
said
re
it was accomplished with?
a minimum of real sort of fighting going on.
Right.
With regard to Hirsch, though, there is the real question of the reporting, because although he's broken many important stories in the last 10 years, he's written a lot of stories that are, to say the least, wildly implausible and sometimes just seem to be untrue. He's gone off sort of half-cocked on questions of war with Iran. He wrote a major piece for the London Review of Books claiming that Turkey, of all things, was behind the serious chemical weapons attacks in Ghouta, a claim that for which his data was very scanty and which didn't make any sense in the first place. And here again, there are some real questions about what's going on here. The most important claim in the story is that the ISI, excuse me, was holding bin Laden prisoner in the Abbottabad compound, and that the Saudis knew about it and were partly bankrolling it, but that they were vo very strongly resistant to letting the Americans actually talk to bin Laden because of some potentially incriminating information he might have had. So that the deal they made was that the US could stage a raid. Why would they stage a raid when bin Laden was being held prisoner? I don't know. But the raid had to involve killing bin Laden. It's a very weird and convoluted and complicated story that I find hard to believe. And it is true if you read in detail, it seems like some of the people Hirsch is talking to have real animus against how Obama handled at least the PR for the attack, and that may be part of the motivation for this story.
Rahul, thanks as always for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week.
See you then.
Rahul Mahajan is a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. With the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement, one of the important issues that have been raised, in addition to police brutality, of course, is the depiction of African Americans and people of color at large in the media. The protests in Baltimore showcased the failure of corporate media to portray accurately and with appropriate perspective what was unfolding on the ground. A prominent case in point was an exchange between Wolf Blitzer and well-known activist DeRay McKesson.
Yep. And remember, the people that have been violent since August have been the police. We think about the 300 people that have been killed this year alone, like that is violence. There's been property damage here that's been really unfortunate over the past couple for a day or so here. But remember, there have been many days of peaceful protest here in Baltimore City and in places all around the country.
But at least 15 police officers have been hurt, 200 arrests, 144 vehicle fires. These are statistics local police have put out, 15 structure fires. There's no excuse for that kind of violence, right?
Yeah, and there's no excuse for the 7 people that the Baltimore City Police Department has killed in the past year either, right?
We're not making comparisons. Obviously, we don't want anybody hurt, but I just want to hear you say that there should be peaceful protests, not violent protests, in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah, there should be peaceful protests, and I don't have to condone it to understand it, right? That the pain that people feel is real, and you are making a comparison. You are suggesting this idea that broken windows are worse than broken spines, right? And what we know to be true is that the police are killing people everywhere. They're killing people here. 6 police officers were involved in the killing of Freddie Gray, and we're looking for justice there. And that's real, right? That, like, the violence that the police have been inflicting on communities of color has been sustained and deep.
But you agree, I assume, with President Obama, who just said a few moments ago, there's no excuse for the violence that erupted yesterday. There's no excuse for the stealing, no excuse for the arson. You agree with the president?
What I agree with is that I advocate people to peacefully protest. I also know that pain manifests in different ways, and I don't have to condone it to understand it. People are grieving and people are mourning. And I would advocate personally for people to do it in ways that you are calling peacefully. But again, I also know that Freddie Gray will never be back and that those windows will be.
And that was DeRay McKesson standing up to Wolf Blitzer of CNN. With its fixation on property destruction over police violence and the repeated use of the words thugs and criminals and vandals to describe rioters, a huge disconnect with grassroots communities has become visible. Joining me in studio to discuss this and other issues is one of our daily news analysts who just happens to be in town. Chenjerai Kumanyika is a communications professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. Welcome live in studio. This morning, Chenjerai.
Yes, nice to be here. Great to be here.
It's so wonderful to have you in person here. First, what do you make of this exchange between Wolf Blitzer and DeRay McKesson? Wolf Blitzer just repeatedly tried to get him to agree with him, which is just bizarre. I've never seen a journalist do that to somebody before. He says, I just want to hear you say that there should be peaceful protests in the tradition of Martin Luther King.
He was so persistent with that, right? I mean, it was just
patronizing.
No, I mean, I was watching this coverage as it happened, and CNN, you know, they really have a history of this kind of coverage, but this was particularly egregious in the case of Baltimore. I mean, just patronizing, repeating these media frames. So, you know, there's a great article by Scott Timberg at Salon where we have media scholar Todd Gitlin. I mean, he talks about his media frames and the way that these frames go back all the way for decades. You know, the frames of thugs, framing stories about protests as actually being kind of like crime stories. And so I think we have to look at these stories, which seem to be individual cases, and see how they pretty much fall into this typical media frame where we just equates protesters with thugs and things like this.
There was also the Fox News moment, the Geraldo Rivera. Actually, there were several moments with Geraldo during the Baltimore protests. One activist during one point yelled at him on live TV saying, stop making money out of black pain. At another time, one activist who eventually was identified as Kwame Rose confronted him about his biased coverage. And he said he wanted Fox News out of Baltimore. And it was an amazing moment. Here's an excerpt of that exchange.
Because you're not here reporting about the boarded up homes and the homeless people under MLK. You're not reporting about the poverty levels up and down North Avenue.
Exactly.
2 years ago, when the 300 man marched and we marched from the top of Hilton to from Hilton and North to Milton and North, you weren't here. But you're here for the black riots that happened. You're not here. You're not here for the death of Freddie Gray. You're here for your story.
And that is an excerpt of an exchange that actually a confrontation that a young activist was bold enough to do with Geraldo Rivera. We saw Fox News. Should we consider CNN and Fox News as closer on this spectrum than we normally do?
Absolutely. I don't make a distinction. This is corporate media. And what we really have to begin to talk about is how media, these cable news stations, who are really just simply concerned with ratings and using the spectacle of black death for ratings, how they've become complicit in the multi-layers of violence. I mean, there's a kind of symbolic violence that is involved with the way that we imagine black males, black women, that we imagine marginalized people, transgender people. I mean, the media is, mainstream media is complicit with this. And so I think that we have to look at Fox, CNN, and even I have to include MSNBC to some extent as complicit in this.
And the other part of the story is the media deciding which stories are worth reporting and which ones aren't. We heard Kwame Rose saying, you weren't here for the death of Freddie Gray, because, of course, the media only come when there's a spectacle to watch. And they also decide, of course, which stories are worth reporting on police brutality. There's, in particular, the cases of black women victims of police brutality. There was case of Natasha McKenna, a black woman who was in police custody. She suffered from mental illness all her life. She was shackled when she was shocked with tasers, and she died in police custody. How important is her story?
Her story is extremely important, and I feel like now we're going to see the attention of the Black Lives Matter movement, that this is the movement with DeRay and Netta, turn to this case, which is, she was, I believe, handcuffed and actually had a restraint face mask on at the time when she was tasered. and they're saying that it was a result of death from excited delirium.
Wow.
So this is really important. And I think that this is going to become important as well as we begin to see these movements connect issues like, you know, the criminalization of mental illness and the criminalization of all different types of social insecurity and marginalization. So, yeah, really important case.
So when you this thing that you just brought up, death from excited delirium, of course, this sounds similar to the story that was being spun about Freddie Gray, who had been just beaten, shackled, and the police want us to believe that he killed himself because he was banging around in the vehicle on his own. This sort of narrative that African-Americans in police custody have some sort of death wish, we're supposed to believe this?
Exactly. No, I mean, it's just an absurd claim on its face. And I think the other thing we should look at is there's a Mother Jones article that talks about how the Taser company in its promotional materials actually suggests to police departments that they should maybe consider excited this exact diagnosis or whatever it is as a cause of death, and say frequently individuals have this. So there's a lot of problems.
So that if people die when they're tasered, that it's probably because of something else rather than the taser.
Right, exactly. So that's really worrisome. We should begin to turn our attention toward the company as well in this regard.
And this weekend, Michelle Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, spoke at Tuskegee University, and it seemed like she sort of uncharacteristically opened up in front of a large audience about the toll that racism has taken on her life. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be a slightly different form of racism because, of course, there's a class issue, there's a political, position to have at stake. But she said this a little bit before, the people at formal events who assumed you were the help, those who've questioned our intelligence, our honesty, and even our love of this country. How important is it for her to speak out?
I think that, you know, the role that the Obamas play in being able to shift conversations and control conversations and bring these issues is important. I mean, what they've actually been able to accomplish in terms of actual policies and things like this, we know that this is, you know, worrisome and disappointing in a lot of ways. But the symbolic role, I think, is really important. So I'm glad that she brought that conversation. Mm.
And is there a difference between Michelle Obama telling us about what's happened to her versus a poor black woman on the street? I mean, you know, everything is in one's perception. Michelle Obama, and we've seen this when Oprah has told us stories about how she's been, you know, mistaken for somebody without money if she's showed up at a jewelry store wearing a baseball hat.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, it's when certain people speak, there are certain bodies, certain kinds of crimes are seen as grievable, seen as worrisome, but we have to draw all kinds of people into the conversation, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how black folks fought against media bias in the last few months and to the past year, because I think it's important about the fact that people do have agency and they're using it. As we saw in these confrontations that we just played with the media, the activists have been tremendous in standing up for themselves, expressing their anger eloquently, articulately, and people have very much taken to social media to fight back. The black Twitter sphere is so active. How have people called out media coverage, for example, on Twitter?
Well, yeah, you've got it. I mean, I think there's a couple of ways. One is by promoting the stories that we think are, you know, important, and by showing, you know, as moments of absurd CNN coverage, you know, people are able to take pictures of it and really highlight and point out those moments that just would otherwise be, you know, lost. There's also the importance of live stream, which is really, I think, an important method. And, you know, we can get to that when we talk about on the ground in Ferguson.
Yeah, let's actually talk about that. This is basically a program that allows people to simply have a web camera running live at an event and offer people an unfiltered glimpse into what's happening. Are you talking about the live stream that was showing the streets of Ferguson when it was announced that Darren Wilson wouldn't be indicted? I was watching that.
That's right,
that
yeah.
Evening. Yeah.
Well, you know, live stream is important on so many levels. It's really, I think, at the center of contemporary social justice activism movements right now. There's a couple of platforms that are doing it, and now I think there's a couple of new platforms, Meerkat, and there's another one called Periscope, and these go right to Twitter. But activists are using this. They play an important role in defending activists, actually, from the police. Not all protests have 200 people. Sometimes there's 50 people marching, and police can become very bold. But when they have a camera in their face, this changes the dynamic. So that's also working together with Twitter It's really important with the live stream.
And you were on the streets of Ferguson, and I want to actually ask you to talk a little bit about the role that you've been playing. And this is sort of a, you know, some have characterized it as a modern role, the modern academic activist. You're a professor at Clemson University, but you're also an activist, and you're also very active in social media. How have you, just describe your role in the past few months that you've seen.
Well, you know, years ago, when I was coming into the academy. You know, first of all, I come from a family background of activists.
Your father was a very prominent civil rights activist.
That's right.
Makaza Kumanyika, who in New York. Tell us, actually, if you want to set the stage even for that, further back.
Yeah, well, my father was, he ran the Bronx chapter of CORE for many years. And he was
Congress of Racial Equality.
Yes, and he was a labor activist. And, he was, you know, so I have that's going on in my family. And, you know, coming into the academy, I never believed in this idea that, you know, academics should be separate from the struggles. In fact, I think that they have to find ways to be engaged. There's a scholar at Rutgers whose name is Deepa Kumar, who I had a chance to, like, talk with earlier on, and she talked about ways to do that. So what I've been trying to do is to navigate it. And it's difficult because I have, you know, demands that I have to, of what I have to do with my school. Some of the positions that I take are controversial, and there's been some people who haven't been happy about it. But mostly.
And you're also a dad, I should add. you have a family.
Well, I have a family. Yeah. You know, and so, yeah. Actually, my wife is right there with me, and she's also an activist. And her name is Sadaka Kumanyika. And so she plays a key role. And, so far we've been able to make it work. But I think the idea is what we're seeing is many professors involved with the struggle and not trying to, like, sort of be separate or understood as being, like, in the ivory tower type thing.
And so you were there in Ferguson, and you used your smartphone and camera and actively. I mean, how what does the modern activist academic look like when one is in the middle of, throngs of justifiably angry people who are trying to change an unjust system?
Well, the first thing I think is that, you know, in the Tao Te Ching, they said, if you want to lead, you have to be able to follow. So I think the first thing you have to do is humble yourself and learn and understand what the situation is. There's activists who have been there for a long time. And so it's not a thing where as an academic, you're going to come in and try to exert some type of authority. So one of the things I learned quickly was that I could play a role in terms of resources that I might have access to. I could play a role in terms of being able to live stream and sort of just support. And so that was really what I was doing. And I ultimately became a live streamer in Ferguson and played it and really tried to get involved with the, when they had the mall shutdowns, the Black Friday mall shutdowns,
right.
Very much involved in documenting those.
Right.
And then I think we can also sort of back out for a minute and then add historical context to it. We can write, you know, although no academic I know is as productive as you in the writing.
Oh, jeez. I'm not an academic,
right.
But thank you.
Yes, so I think, you know, we have some things to learn from the journalists in that regard.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the fact that there is a huge problem with the absence of people of color behind the microphones, and also in the boardrooms and editorial staff of newsrooms around the country. You know, of course, there's no easy fix, and one can simply put people of color in certain positions and expect change to happen, and it may not happen. But at the very basic level, how important is the fact that there just aren't enough people of color in the mainstream media?
Yes, I mean, I think this is a huge problem, and it's one, you know, it's not a new problem. It's one that people have been trying to fight in public broadcasting, but the reality is that, you know, we just have a cast of journalists, people in the editorial rooms, people with decision-making power who represent really what the public look like. So in my piece, I ask what really, you know, who is the public in public media?
Yeah,
really?
You wrote about this. And actually, you, I want to talk about the piece that you wrote about NPR, where you wrote this wonderful conversation, this sort of conversation you had with a reader about this topic of code switching. And people of color often struggle with this. When we're in the media, we're expected to talk like white folks and have the politics of white America or the middle class or the elite. Tell us about your critique of NPR in particular, which you call challenging the whiteness of public radio.
Yeah, I mean, this was a conversation that we've had, and it's been really instructive to see what came out of it. I think the key thing is that even when you have, you know, black bodies in the room, black journalists working, like, I don't know, Don Lemon, you know. What this reveals is that we have to also incorporate other modes of storytelling, and we have to empower really a different culture. It's not just about having people come into the newsroom and reproduce the culture that we've seen. So
I mean, there's a role of there's a whole question of accents and how people talk.
That's right. But in the state of California, I mean, you know, the majority of, you know, white people are a minority. You know, they're not a majority. So we need to. So does what we do, what we hear on the radio, does that really reflect the forms of cultural wisdom that's in those different ways of speaking in the Latino community? You know,
right? Because when we only hear one manner of talking, we subconsciously, make the other modes of communication subservient.
Absolutely.
So when people do encounter those in real life, if they don't already, then in our minds we treat people differently, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what we have to begin to do is unpack when people say things like, well, they're just being professional, because there's a lot of people who, you know, listen and they're like, oh, well, you just need a professional, you need a standard. You know, racial hierarchies, gender hierarchies hide in that word of professional.
Professional.
It's really about making who's going to be comfortable, who gets to be comfortable, and whose ear has to reach a little bit, and who has to learn something, right? And so I think we have to unpack those kinds of things.
And I have to tell you, at one point I met once with a higher up in a local NPR station that shall remain unnamed, who complimented me because, but you don't even have much of an accent. And I thought, well, I've never ever thought that that was a problem, even if I did. But of course, this is an issue. Now, people are slowly breaking into the media. And as we were saying earlier, they're creating their own media as well. There's also the issue of pop culture, Chenjerai, which I think is important, right? Because we've got news, which influences people. But Hollywood, pop culture, what's on television, what's in our movie screens also deeply influences people. And there's a huge issue that we've discussed on our program many times about the lack of diversity in that aspect, in the entertainment media as well.
That's right. That's right.
How important is that?
I think it's extremely important. And what we're starting to see is when you have narratives that come into popular culture, they can have a really important impact on social justice issues. Mm-hmm. Think about, for example, Fruitvale Station, you know, and the impact that that's had, you know.
There's an amazing film by a young Oakland-based filmmaker about the killing of Oscar Grant, yeah. And of course, snubbed by the Oscars.
Right. No nominations, no discussion.
Not a single nod to it. Another film that, of course, in the past year that has taken, you know, the country by storm was Selma by Ava DuVernay, which was also largely snubbed by the Oscars. I think got one major nomination. People were very upset with Selma, but not so overtly. There were rumblings in the media about the fact that Selma's portrayal of President Johnson was a problem because it showed him as being resistant to civil rights.
Right.
Because we're so used to the narrative of the white savior.
Where's our white savior? Right, you know. Yeah, no, I think Selma was a really important film. And, you know, as a professor, I required my students to see this film. And so I can attest to the impact that this had, you know, really looking at that generation. Also, many student activists I know went and took trips to go see Selma. So really, this film really had a way of showing them, making the historical connections between what was going on at that point and the current movement.
And it's, of course, so interesting to see this film made by a black woman with a primarily black cast, without the white savior narrative, essentially breaking into a Hollywood lockout that many would say, not just of women and women filmmakers, but filmmakers of color, on a story that's really important. And everybody wants to invoke Martin Luther King, right? Wolf Blitzer wants peaceful protests in the tradition of Martin Luther King. But what did you make of her portrayal of this man?
Well, you know, I think what she does that's so important is she reclaims Martin Luther King as someone who was really about, a fairly radical form of, you know, like civil disobedience, and, you know, and enables us to envision what that was like. And I think that that's important for those who want to sort of give us a sanitized version of King and kind of invoke him to somehow condemn civil disobedience. It's also important, I think, for people in other parts of, you know, black struggle who want to see Martin Luther King as though, you know, the form of nonviolent protest that they were doing was not dangerous or was not radical. I think you get a sense in that film, like, this was not easy to walk and face that kind of violence. So.
Yeah, I mean, it was nonviolent only in that the protesters didn't fight back against the people who were beating up on them. It was extremely violent against them.
That's right.
Well, finally, Chenjerai, I wanted just to ask you to, you know, in terms of what you foresee happening in the next few months as people fight not just police brutality and the justice system to try to get justice, but also fight against biased media coverage. What do you hope can happen in the next year or so at, I think, a very important and pivotal time in the history of racial justice in the United States? Are you, do you think that this is that crucial a moment that we're living in today?
I really do. I mean, I think always the most important time, as Talib said in his song, the most important time in history is now, the present, always. But I think that the momentum of these movements, the Black Lives Matter movement, the This Is the Movement with Netta and DeRay, really has momentum. People have tools that they're creating their own media. You know, one organization I work with, Street Poets Inc., you know, they are doing their own media and really doing a powerful thing. They're having their 20th anniversary this year.
Tell us about this organization.
Yeah, well, Street Poets does extremely powerful work around the community in Los Angeles, in the juvenile detention camps, but also out in the community. And they've now been working for 20 years, and they're really kind of transforming youth and using the power of marginalized youth to actually heal the community. So I definitely encourage you to check them out, Street Poets Inc. But, you know, there's all these movements that are coming together. You know, people talking about one, it was really encouraging to see that, you know, issues of the transgender community and those kinds of things are coming together with the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, really the Black Lives Matter movement was started by those individuals. Mm-hmm. But I think that all those connections is really encouraging.
Well, Chenjerai, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest, Chenjerai Kumanyika, is a communications professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. 100 years ago, one of the most important social and political upheavals of the 20th century took place in Mexico. The Mexican Revolution, which started in 1910, was not only significant because of how it shaped Mexico until today, but also because there's a rich history of women soldiers that my guest, Nao Bustamante, has studied and featured in art form. Many women became soldiers or soldaderas in the rebellion and came to be known as Adelitas. A woman named Leandra Becerra Lumbreras, who lived to be 127-year-old and earned the distinction of being the oldest person alive, was also the last survivor of the Mexican War. She died this past March. And my guest, Nao Bustamante, had the chance to meet her. Nao is an associate professor of new media and live art at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. She has an exhibit entitled Soldadera at the Vincent Price Museum in Southern California, starting in mid-May. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to the program.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Well, this is a little-known story here in the United States, to hear that there were these women soldiers fighting in the Mexican Revolution. So can you shed some light for our audience? I'd certainly never known that this was happening. In what capacity were women part of this war?
Well, they were actually there in every capacity you can imagine. I mean, I think a lot of people imagine that they were sort of supply lines workers, you know, people who were there supplying food, supplying care, medical care, but they were also on horseback, they were also fighting, there were also women who were leading different groups of people, both men and women. The woman that you spoke of, Leandra Becerra Lumbreras, who was a wonderful spirit, she just passed on March 19th, but I was able to meet her before then, and I was able to go film with her and her family. And she said that she fought with tortillas as opposed to fighting with weapons. Hmm. So she essentially was leading a group of women who were traveling alongside battalions of men and women, and they were preparing food, caring for the children, and sometimes they would go ahead or behind of the group and set up camp. And they would take with them miniature kitchens with them, so miniature stones and miniature pots and everything so that they could prepare food. They were carrying whole kitchens on their backs. They were foraging for wild food. They were hunting, and they were essentially feeding the army.
Wow. So that was one capacity that they participated in. But were there women on the front lines as well?
There were women on the front lines. And, you know, it's interesting because we don't hear a lot about these women. We hear, you know, maybe about one or two. But when I started going through the photo archive, I found many, many photos of women who were brandishing weapons, who were dirty, who had looked like they had been in the field for years, essentially, with the men. And I started being curious about their role in the Mexican Revolution. And I started actually marking this kind of space, this trajectory, particularly through political cartoons and political editorial cartoons, where initially the women appeared very petite and a kind of Victorian era, very like tiny size next to the men in the cartoons. Almost like they were drawn in a different field or a different world. And then as the revolution started to pick up, so, you know, around 1914 or so, the women started taking on these kind of monstrous figures with like oversized heads and teeth and really monstrous faces.
Wow.
And then over time, the women became actually looking like they were from the same world as the men in the cartoons. So it was a very bizarre trajectory to follow as an artist, just to follow sort of the visual landscape of the popular, you know, culture that was being produced during the wartime efforts.
So they came to be called, and I mentioned this earlier, as the Adelitas. Tell us about this myth. Is somewhat idealized myth?
Well, the Adelita is often seen in contemporary terms as a kind of, you know, heroic figure, but really a kind of, you know, breasts forward, wind blowing in the hair, holding the flag, and being, you know, this, I guess this kind, almost like a Lady Liberty, I guess, for the Mexican Revolution, but this very sexualized figure. And
feminized.
I would say even just, feminized, but really sexualized, you know, really like as if the breasts were her guns, right? Just like, you know, moving forward into the world. But really these women were, you know, gritty, they were caring.
Where does that myth come from? I mean, I guess we see that in so many contexts as well.
Right. I think that a lot of times this is something that's developed by, you know, soldiers and by men who are trying to inspire themselves maybe to carry on and carry forward. So this is something we've seen over and over again in different wartime situations. But part of my interest in this is actually thinking about how to protect women in wartime situations and in frontline situations, because now the frontline has moved over top of women in different kinds of wartime scenarios throughout the world, right? And so what I did was I made these Kevlar fighting costumes, which are made from bullet-resistant Kevlar.
This is part of your performance work in bringing forward this history.
Yeah, and they're also in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. But really, it's just to imagine or to think about or to time travel these women to protect them against the weapons from that era. So I'm testing these fighting costumes, what I'm deeming fighting costumes, against the weapons that were used between 1910 and 1920 in the Mexican Revolution.
So when you say that they faced a lot of weapons during war, rape is inevitably a weapon of war, almost, you know, in any context, whether you're talking about contemporary or historic Mexico, the U.S. or Asia or elsewhere. Did that happen in the Mexican Revolution in terms of, it probably happened, but was it documented? Were the soldaderas particularly targeted?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, yes, you know, rape happens in the context of any society, unfortunately, and it's something that we, you know, have to always stand up against. But I think within the soldadera units, often what was happening as well was that they were traveling in groups together, groups, large groups of women. So they had a lot more protection than one might have by themselves or located in their own home even, right, when the villager, when they were raiding villages. And a lot of times women were swept up in the raids in terms of they had to choose sides because of the urgency of the war, because the war was, in a way, it was improvised, right? It was haphazard. It was improvised. The communication lines weren't always happening, so they didn't always know what one battalion was doing versus another. And so the women had to make snap decisions about which side to join and which side not to join. Zapata had many women following him and with his group because I think he had a very strong reputation for caring for the women and for being respectful to them. And so they really flocked to his battalion and to support his groups. And there were a lot of stories, you know, sort of oral histories about him delivering women back to their own village or back to their own parents or back to their own family.
And how relevant is the history of women in the Mexican Revolution to today? I mean, we know, for example, that there are many women soldiers in the Zapatista Revolution of Zapatista Army of National Liberation. Is that a tradition that Mexico, I mean, here in the U.S., we may not know much about this history, but how well known is it in Mexico? And how much do people and women in Mexico, you know, put that forward as far as you know?
Well, you know, of course, Mexico is just steeped in the history. They're living inside of it. So their boulevards and their streets are named after these revolutionary fighters and figures that brought forth the new constitution, the new era, the PRI of Mexico, right, which came from the revolutionary fighters. Now, of course, that has shifted over time. And the thing is that it's very similar to many wars, and even to the current situation in the United States. Really, they were fighting against what we now refer to as the one percenters, right? But in those times, they were really fighting in feudal states, and they were essentially slaves on the land, right? And a lot of the money that was being generated in Mexico through the wealth of the Mexican resources was taken over by American and European business people. And so, you know, the progress and the things that were being developed in Mexico at the time, like the railroads and infrastructure, were essentially destroyed by the end of the Mexican Revolution. But the Mexican people built it all back up. And, you know, they definitely, you know, changed the literacy rates and the education of the time. So there was a lot of progress made through the Mexican Revolution. I won't say it was for naught. Many people fought. It was a hard and bloody 10 years. And they made major gains in terms of, you know, the lives of people and retaining land. In fact, Leandra, she was a woman that at the end of the revolution, she stood in line with her three sons, who she gave birth to during the time of the revolution.
Wow.
And she got to the front of the line, even though the line was all men, and she said, "My sons were there in the revolution, and I want land for them." And she got it. She got it.
This was the 127-year-old woman that you had the chance to meet and interview before she passed away in March, the oldest living human being at the time of her death, and
yes,
also the oldest survivor of the Mexican Revolution. Were women, as far as you know, involved in the writing of the Constitution? What happened to them after the war? Women like Leandra got some land, but were they involved in the sort of political future of Mexico?
Well, they were. They were. They didn't really want to go backwards at that point, and I think that happens a lot of times you'll see in history during wartime situations where women are essentially called on to take up the slack, right, or do jobs or support the war effort. They find themselves having more agency than they had previously, and they don't want to go back. So that was a really important time for women because they found that they had respect, they had positions, they were taken, you know, just out of the role of caring for the family, caring for the house, caring for children, and they liked that. And so I think that was a really important time for women's liberation movements in Mexico.
Now, let's talk about art, since you are primarily an artist, and the exhibits that you're involved in currently at the Vincent Price Museum, or it will be starting May 16th, and then going to Buffalo, New York at the end of September for our East Coast audiences. How important is art to, as a form for reviving some of this history?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that history lives in books, and history lives in stories that are told to individuals and told through families. But art is a way to bring all of this together and to sort of re-envision, reimagine, create a new entrance into the conversation. And that's part of what I wanted to do with my art practice, was really just to begin the conversation, imagine these different lives of women, and allow people to enter with their own imaginations these different stories that are being told in the exhibition, through the films that I'm creating, through the costumes, through the photo collages. But really, it's just a conversation that I want to keep extending. And after visiting Leandra and her family, I found what I had on my hands was actually documentary footage. And so I'm actually moving forward in creating a documentary about women in this wartime. The jumping off point is women in the Mexican Revolution. But we can expand that to look at contemporary women and the kind of trials they face and the kind of protections they need. And so I'm working on a futuristic fighting costume, which of course will be absurd because nobody could possibly be protected against contemporary war. Mm. And that's part of, I guess, what the art is trying to say, is that we can't protect ourselves against war. Mm. Our only option is to get rid of war.
So a little bit more on the costumes that you made for the current exhibit that we were talking about earlier, these dresses made of Kevlar, which is mm-hmm. bulletproof material. You made these dresses in the sort of, in the actual period piece, and they're historically accurate. And then what did you do with them?
Well, the first dress that I made, we called it Tierra y Libertad, which is a cry of the yeah. Mexican Revolution, right? Land or liberty, land and liberty. And we took them into the field and we shot them with weapons from the era, from the Mexican Revolution. And we tested them, and they actually stopped a 9mm slug.
Wow.
Twice.
Wow.
So the apron of the dress, which had multi-layers of Kevlar, which was protecting the heart and the internal organs, was able to stop 2 9-millimeter slugs. And the dress was tested somewhat, weapons grade tested, as they called it, but not in a scientific manner.
And so your point was to in 100 years after these events happened, preserve these women?
Yes, it was a way of sort of time traveling to protect them, to go back in time and say, we appreciate what you did. Mm-hmm. We understand what you did. We understand why you did it. Mm-hmm. And we want to protect you, right? And so there was a way in which visiting Leandra was also a kind of time travel experience, you know, just to actually touch her,
yeah.
to touch somebody who was alive,
there,
you
yeah.
know, materially alive
yeah.
in 1910 mm-hmm. and there participating. Was really wild. And she was this amazing person, this amazing figure that kind of lived between history and the living moment.
There's also another work that you've done related to the Mexican Revolution. Among the many depictions of history, of the history of Mexico and the Mexican Revolution, is the 1930 film project by famed Russian filmmaker Sergei Eisenstein called Que Viva Mexico. And the film was never finished, but you imagined a new ending or a new chapter for the film. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, oddly, this is weird because, you know, oddly, when I was, looking through the archives and trying to find the women in the archives, it was then another scholar came to me and said, well, you've heard of the unfinished film of Eisenstein, right? Soldadera. And I said, no, I haven't heard of this. And essentially, he made a film that he produced for about 3 months in Mexico in the 30s. And it was later cut and released in different kind of tourist montages, but also as a film called Que Viva Mexico. And there was one section he was unable to finish because he lost funding. There were different rumors circulating about him, why he had to go back to Russia. But he lost funding, and he was unable to record the section called Soldadera. Oddly, because here was somebody who was trying to bring them attention, and even that was cut short.
And so this
and even that film wasn't able to be made. But there was a script that existed.
Oh, wow. How did you find that?
Well, it's widely available in his writings. And so I ended up taking parts of the script and parts of my script and kind of smooshing them together and making a kind of psychedelic reenactment of the film. And so there's parts of that in there, and you know, parts of course from my own ideas, and then the backdrops are the archival photos from the UC Riverside Special Collections.
And so even just a few years after the end of the Mexican Revolution, when someone attempted to in film form memorialize the role of women, somehow that part got left out.
Mm-hmm. It did, but you know, the really interesting and bizarre thing is that in filming Leandra, I've been working with this footage of her, and in it she's speaking to a woman named Pancha or Panchita. Often she's talking to this woman, Pancha, Panchita, leave that, let me help you with this. And Eisenstein's main character in his script was named Pancha, Panchita. So there are some really interesting kind of circles that are coming together in the work. So I'm in some kind of artistic vortex, pulling in all these elements of history and, you know, trying to pull something together for the public.
How important is it now, as we wrap up our conversation, for us to remember, particularly at our current time, when even though women have made so many gains worldwide, they are still the primary victims of violence and war. I mean, even in Mexico itself, women who have been disappeared and raped and murdered, the economic violence that they face every day, to remember these important moments in history, mm-hmm. Can that influence mm-hmm. the present?
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I mean, you know, we look at a time where women had agency, and it's beyond disturbing to think about the ways in which women are seen as expendable and seen as property all over the world. And so, you know, in places like here in the United States, where we do have agency, where we do have our independence, really important for us to speak up for women in other locations that don't have that voice and to try to help them. But, you know, I think I don't really understand it. I mean, I would like to believe that in my lifetime that I'll see a kind of, you know, second enlightenment or a way towards peace. I don't know if it's greed. I don't know if it's psychosis of some sort. You know, I don't know what it is that keeps people marching towards killing each other, abusing each other. I don't understand it. But I would like for us to be able to work towards ending that cycle of violence, particularly towards women.
And also in terms of how we see women being, and I mentioned the sort of economic injustice that they're fighting against, going back to mm-hmm. the premise of the Mexican Revolution as being a fight against the one percenters. Mm-hmm. Even though women have agency here in the United States, poor women are suffering from a severe state repression in terms of welfare recipients mm-hmm. being drug tested, women being imprisoned, women being victims of police mm-hmm. violence, and the victims of campus rapes. It can get kind of depressing.
It can get really depressing. And I think our only choice is just to keep these women who have fought so hard in our mind and just continue to march forward and to march towards justice. And we know what that is. Everyone knows what that is in their heart. Yeah. They know what economic justice looks like. Yeah. And they know what social justice looks like. And we need to just continue to march towards that no matter what.
How did you get involved? How did you find this topic, or did it find you?
Well, it found me, as does most of my art practice. And bizarrely, it came out of me appearing on a reality show on Bravo called Work of Art, America's Next Great Artist.
Wow.
I know. Strange, right? And so I was on this show. It was 2009 it aired, and I sort of hit the mainstream. And I was getting all these sort of slings and arrows, both good and bad commentary passed to me, and a lot of the commentary was really just disgusting remarks about my body, primarily, in a kind of troll situation. And I thought, I would love to create a talisman. And I imagined this dress that was all the way up to the neck, all the way down on my sleeve, so that was made of Kevlar. And then at that, within those 2 days, someone invited me to make work about the Mexican Revolution for a show. These curators, Marcus Quilin Nazario and Pilar Perez, invited me to be in a show called From Chewbacca to Zapata, Reenvisioning the Mexican Revolution. Mm. And so I started doing a little bit of research, and I found these women fighters that were wearing the same clothes as the dress I had imagined making for myself. And so at that point, I decided I'm going to go back in time and try to protect these women.
Hmm. That's a really personal story. That's amazing. And of course, that is also an important issue that today, despite the fact that women have so much agency, have the social media and the internet, women are often attacked verbally in horrible ways.
Yes.
And it's cruel, and it's a symptom of the kind of disgusting misogyny and sexism that pervades our culture. And I'm so glad to see a woman like you fighting back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and best of luck to you and all the work that you're doing.
Thank you, and thank you for your work also.
My guest is Nao Bustamante. She is an associate professor of new media and live art at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. And for our Southern California audience, her exhibit at the Vincent Price Museum entitled Soldadera will be opening May 16th. For our East Coast audience, later in the year, in September, she's going to be showing in Buffalo, New York. We'll post all of the details at our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. Well, we're out of time. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Michelle Zanarosa is our research intern. Dan Swerdlove is our technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. And Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. By the way, unfortunately, we only have a few weeks worth of funding left for our TV production, and so we're hoping that you'll subscribe to our YouTube channel, because your subscription supports our TV production. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.